Hi, I'm Rob Nadelson. A common accusation, especially from liberal academics and judges, is that many constitutional phrases are vague or meaningless, or as stated by former Supreme Court Justice William J. Brennan, they are luminous and obscure. Advocates of an all-powerful central government draw two lessons from their belief that constitutional clauses are vague. The first lesson is that the document doesn't deserve great respect because it isn't well drafted. The second lesson is that vagueness justifies a very wide scope for exercise of federal and judicial power. But the charge of vagueness is based on ignorance. The usual reason critics think constitutional phrases are vague or meaningless is that they don't know that those phrases had specialized meanings in 18th century law. The Constitution is a legal document, and most of the framers and leading ratifiers were top-flight lawyers. In the founding era, even the general public was unusually knowledgeable about law. Hence, many of the Constitution's ordinary-sounding expressions are packed with legal content. Here are some illustrations. Regulate commerce. Establish post offices. The phrase, post roads. The phrase natural-born citizen, or corruption of blood, or privileges and immunities, and necessary and proper. Several years ago, I wrote a book explaining these and other terms. Behind that book were many individual investigations into the true meaning of constitutional words and phrases. Following is the story of one investigation. Critics leveling the vagueness charge long pointed to the necessary and proper clause as an example. Confused law professors and students scratched their heads over the clause, and the most important Supreme Court case on the subject, Chief Justice John Marshall's famous opinion in McCulloch versus Maryland, confused them too. Some tagged it as the elastic clause and claimed it could justify almost anything. The Necessary and Proper Clause is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 10. It ends a long list of powers the Congress grants to Congress. It reads as follows, and I'm quoting here, "The Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States, or in any department or officer thereof." So to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution other listed powers. Critics asked, what makes a law necessary to carry out another power? What does proper mean? Moreover, the Constitution grants authority only to agencies and officials like the President or Congress. The phrase powers vested in the government of the United States, they thought that must be a typo. No one seems to have consulted 18th century legal materials about these questions until I did so, beginning in 2003. Now, I labored under some disadvantages. I had no internet access to materials I needed. The law school where I was a faculty member had only a small library, and it was 200 miles from any other law school. The administration was uninterested in my research. In fact, the law school administration was even hostile. But I had one huge advantage that the overwhelming majority of other constitutional scholars did not have. I had actually practiced law and had done so for many years. And although my law practice was in the 20th century rather than in the 18th, I had worked with many of the same kinds of legal documents the founders employed. As I examined the necessary and proper clause, a little voice told me, "You've seen this kind of wording before. It looks like a phrase in a trust instrument or an agency agreement." During my law practice, I'd frequently consulted form books. Form books are huge collections of sample documents and lawyers traditionally use these books and the forms in them to draft legal instruments. I bet there were form books in the 18th century, And if there were, I probably can find language in them that looks a lot like necessary and proper. Shortly thereafter, I visited Philadelphia. The law librarian at the University of Pennsylvania, which by the way was Ben Franklin's favorite school, gave me access to their rare book collection. It turned out that there were plenty of 18th century form books. While thumbing through one of them, I found a form for a letter of attorney. That's a kind of agency agreement. We call it a power of attorney today. What I saw was the following phrase in this form, quote, execute and perform all other things whatsoever, which are necessary and proper. Further checking confirmed that letters of attorney and other documents listing powers often finish up the list with an additional grant of necessary and proper powers. I soon found that phrases like necessary and proper also were exceptionally common in English and American statutes, in trusts, leases, commissions, and charters. Study of 18th century English court cases taught me that in this context, the word necessary had a meaning. It meant incidental. I also learned that necessary and proper was a translation of an earlier Latin phrase, necessaria et opportuna. My knowledge of Latin, which by the way is another skill rare among modern academics, my knowledge of Latin confirmed that the word necessary meant incidental. Still more investigation showed that proper meant that the person exercising authority was governed by legal duties of trust, something confirmed in a subsequent study by a scholar at New York University. Investigation also demonstrated that the Constitution really did grant powers to the government of the United States, not just to individual officers or agencies, but to the government itself. These powers were implicit in clauses imposing obligations on the government, such as the Constitution's mandate that the federal government protect the states from invasion or pay the debts accumulated under the Articles of Confederation. The most significant finding, however, was that necessary meant incidental. And here's why. When a document grants a list of explicit powers, it quietly grants unmentioned powers as well. The unmentioned powers permit the agent to carry out his duties by some methods not listed explicitly in the document. For example, depending on local custom, a document authorizing a person to manage a store might include an unmentioned power to advertise on behalf of the store. Unmentioned powers are called incidental. 18th century law imposed tight constraints on incidental powers. Incidental powers could be exercised only to carry out listed powers. They had to be less of lesser importance. People in the 18th century usually said they had to be less worthy than the listed powers. They had to be methods customary or reasonably required in the circumstances. Someone given authority to manage a business couldn't claim he had incidental power to use his boss's money to take over an entirely unrelated business. Let's consider an example from the Constitution. The Constitution grants Congress explicit power to regulate commerce among the several states. That's called the Interstate Commerce Clause, regulate commerce among the several states. Those adopting the Constitution understood commerce to be trade among merchants and some associated activities such as navigation and marine insurance. A federal law requiring standardized labels on goods shipped across state lines would be incidental to the commerce power and therefore authorized by the necessary and proper clause. By contrast, manufacturing and agriculture were major economic categories distinct from commerce, even though, as the founders knew, these categories impact each other greatly in the real world. Manufacturing and agriculture were not mere incidents of commerce, though, and a law governing them is not incidental to regulating commerce. Thus, my research taught me that 20th century Supreme Court decisions were wrong when they ruled that the Necessary and Proper Clause gave Congress sweeping power over manufacturing and agriculture. Once you know the background of the Necessary and Proper Clause, you see that it helps make the Constitution flexible. But it doesn't make the Constitution as flaccid as advocates of unlimited federal control would like it to be. The background also helps you grasp the true meaning of Justice Marshall's opinion in McCulloch versus Maryland. I'm happy to report that, possibly based in part on my research, Chief Justice Roberts recaptured some of this original meaning in a case decided in 2012. So it's not the Constitution that's vague or meaningless. On this subject, vagaries exist principally in the minds of the critics. I'm Rob Nadelson. Thanks for listening.